Book 3, The Stand. September 7th, 1980 to January 10th, 1981. I understand you've been running from the man who goes by the name of the Sandman. He flies the sky like an eagle in the eye of a hurricane that's abandoned. America. Hey, Trash, what did old Lady Semple say when you torched her pension check? Carly Yates. When the night is come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see, I won't be afraid just as long as you stand by me. The Drifters. Chapter 51. The dark man had set his guard posts all along the eastern border of Oregon. The largest was at Ontario, where I-80 crosses over from Idaho. There were 6 men there, quartered in the trailer of a large Peterbilt truck. They had been there for more than a week, playing poker the whole time with 20s and 50s as useless as Monopoly money. One man was almost $60,000 ahead. It had rained almost the whole week, and tempers were getting short. They had come out of Portland, and they wanted to get back there. There were women in Portland. Hung from a spike was a powerful two-way radio, broadcasting nothing but static. They were waiting for the radio to broadcast 2 simple words. Come home. That would mean that the man they were looking for had been captured somewhere else. The man they were looking for was approximately 70 years old, heavyset, balding. He wore glasses and he was driving a white over blue 4-wheel drive, either a Jeep or an International Harvester. He was to be killed when he was finally spotted. They were edgy and bored, but not enough so to just take off for Portland on their own. They had received their orders from the walkin' dude himself, and even after rain-induced cabin fever had set in, their terror of him remained. If they screwed the job up and he found out, God help them all. So they sat and played cards and watched by turns. I-80 was deserted in the dull, constant rain. They waited for the scout to happen along here or somewhere else. He's a spy from the other side, the walking dude had told them. That horrible grin wreathed his chops as he spoke. Why it was so horrible, none of them could have said, but when it turned your way, you felt as if your blood had turned to hot soup in your veins. He's a spy, and we could welcome him in with open arms, show him everything, and send him back with no harm done. But I want him. I want them both. And we're going to send their heads back over the mountains before the snow flies. Let them chew on that all winter. And he bellowed hot laughter at the people he had gathered together in one of the conference rooms at the Portland Civic Center. They smiled back, but their smiles were cold and uneasy. Aloud, they might congratulate each other on having been singled out for such a responsibility. But inside, they wished that those happy, awful, weasel-like eyes had fixed on anyone but them. There was another large guard post far south of Ontario, at Shayville. Others were manned by pairs of men, and there were an even dozen of them, ranging from the tiny town of Flora, just off Route 3 and less than 60 miles from the Washington border, all the way down to McDermott, on the Oregon-Nevada border. An old man in a blue and white 4-wheel drive. The instructions to all the sentinels were the same. Kill him, but don't hit him in the head. There was to be no blood or bruise above the throat. I don't want to send back damaged goods, Randy Flagg told them, and clacked and roared his horrible laughter. The northern border between Oregon and Idaho is marked by the Snake River. If you were to follow the Snake north from Ontario, where the 6 men sat in their Peterbilt playing spit in the ocean for worthless money, you would eventually come to within spitting distance of Copperfield. The Snake takes a kink here that geologists call an oxbow. And near Copperfield, the Snake was dammed by the Oxbow Dam. And on that 7th day of September, as Stu Redman and his party trudged up Colorado Highway 6 over 1,000 miles to the east and south, Bobby Terry was sitting inside the Copperfield 5 and Dime, a stack of comic books by his side, wondering what sort of shape the Oxbow Dam was in, and if the sluice gates had been left open or shut. Outside, Oregon Highway 86 ran past the dime store. He and his partner, Dave Roberts, now asleep in the apartment overhead, had discussed the dam at great length. It had been raining for a week. The snake was high. Suppose that old Oxbow Dam decided to let go. Bad news. A rushing wall of water would sweep down on Copperfield, and old Bobby Terry and old Dave Roberts might be washed all the way down to the Pacific Ocean. They had discussed going over to the dam to look for cracks, but finally just hadn't dared. Flagg's orders had been specific. Stay under cover. David pointed out that Flagg might be anywhere. He was a great traveler, and stories had already sprung up about the way he could suddenly appear in a small, out-of-the-way burg where there were only a dozen people repairing power lines or collecting weapons from some army depot. He materialized like a ghost. Only this was a grinning black ghost in dusty boots with run-down heels. Sometimes he was alone, and sometimes Lloyd Henry was with him. Sometimes he was behind the wheel of a big white 62 Thunderbird, and sometimes he was walking. One moment he wasn't there, and the next moment he was. He could be in L.A. one day, or so the talk went, and show up in Boise a day later, on foot. But, as Dave had also pointed out, not even Flagg could be in six different places at the same time. One of them could just scoot over to that damned dam, have a look, and scoot back. The odds in their favor were 1,000 to 1. Good, you do it, Bobby Terry told him. You have my permission. But David declined the invitation with an uneasy grin. Because Flagg had a way of knowing things, even if he didn't turn up on the dime. There were some who said he had an unnatural power over the predators of the animal kingdom. A woman named Rose Kingman claimed to have seen him snap his fingers at a number of crows sitting on a telephone wire, and the crows fluttered down onto his shoulders, this Rose Kingman said, and she further testified that they had croaked, "Flagg, Flagg, Flagg," over and over. That was just ridiculous, and he knew it. Bobby Terry's mother, Dolores, had never raised any fools. He knew the way stories got around, growing between the mouth that spoke and the ear that listened. And how happy the dark man would be to encourage stories like that. But the stories gave him an atavistic little shiver, as though at the core of each there was a nugget of truth. Some said he could call the wolves, or send his spirit into the body of a cat. There was a man in Portland who said he carried a weasel or a fisher or something in that ratty old Boy Scout pack he wore when he was walking. Stupid stuff, all of it, but just suppose he could talk to the animals, like a satanic Dr. Doolittle. And suppose he or Dave walked out to look at that dam in a direct contradiction of his orders and was seen. The penalty for disobedience was crucifixion. Bobby Terry guessed that old dam wouldn't break anyway. He shot a Kent out of the pack on the table and lit up, grimacing at the hot, dry taste. In another 6 months, none of the damn cigarettes would be smokable. Probably just as well. The damn things were death anyway. He sighed and took another comic book off the stack. Some ridiculous fucking thing called Howard Duck, who was supposed to be a master of quack foo. He threw it across the store, and it fluttered down in a tent shape on top of a cash register. It was things like Howard Duck, he thought, that made you believe the world was maybe just as well off destroyed. He picked up the next one, a Superman. There was a hero you could at least sort of believe in. And was just turning to the first page when he saw the Blue Scout go by out front, heading west. Its big tires splashed up muddy sheets of rainwater. Bobby Terry stared at the place where it had passed with his mouth ajar. He couldn't believe that the vehicle they were all looking for had just passed his post. To tell the truth, way down deep, he had suspected this whole thing was nothing but a make-work shit detail. He rushed to the front door and jerked it open. He ran out on the sidewalk, still holding the Superman comic book in one hand. Maybe the thing had been nothing but a hallucination. Thinking about Flagg could get anyone hallucinating. But it wasn't. He caught just a glimpse of the scout's roof as it went down over the next hill and out of town. Then he was running back through the deserted Five and Dime, bawling for Dave at the top of his lungs. The judge held onto the steering wheel grimly, trying to pretend there was no such thing as arthritis. And if there was, he didn't have it. And if he did have it, it never bothered him in damp weather. He didn't try to take it any further because the rain was a fact, a pure de fact, as his father would have said, and there was no hope but Mount Hope. He had been running through rain for the last 3 days. It sometimes backed off to a drizzle, but mostly it had been nothing more or less than a good old solid downpour. and that was a pure D fact. The roads were on the point of washing out in some places, and by next spring a lot of them were going to be flat impassable. The first 3 days, struggling along I-80, had convinced him that he wasn't going to raise the West Coast before the year 2000 if he didn't get off onto the secondary roads. The interstate had been eerily deserted for long stretches, but too many times he had been forced to hook the scout's winch onto some car's back bumper and yank it off the road to make himself a hole he could crawl through. By Rawlins, he'd had enough. He turned northwest, skirted the Great Divide Basin, and had camped 2 days later in Wyoming's northwest corner, east of Yellowstone. Up here, the roads were almost completely empty. Crossing Wyoming and eastern Idaho had been a frightening, dreamlike experience. He would not have thought that the feeling of death could have set so heavily on such an empty land, nor in his own soul. But it was there, a malign stillness under all that big western sky, where once the deer and the Winnebagoes had roamed. It was there in the telephone poles that had fallen over and not been repaired. It was there in the cold, waiting stillness of the small towns he drove his scout through. Lamont, Muddy Gap, Jeffrey City, Lander, Crowheart. His loneliness grew with his realization of the emptiness, with his internalization of the death feeling. He grew more and more certain that he was never going to see the Boulder Free Zone again, or the people who lived there, Franny, Lucy, the Lauder boy, Nick Andros. He began to think he knew how Cain must have felt when God exiled him to the land of Nod. He came into Idaho through the Targhee Pass and had stopped by the roadside for a light lunch. There was no sound but the sullen boil of high water in the nearby creek and an odd grinding sound that reminded him of dirt in a door hinge. Overhead, the blue sky was beginning to silt up with mackerel scales. Wet weather coming, and arthritis coming with it. His arthritis had been very quiet so far, in spite of the exercise and the long hours of driving, and what was that grinding sound? His lunch done, he got his gerund out of the scout and went down to the picnic area by the stream. There was a small grove of trees, several tables spotted among them. And hanging from one of the trees, his shoes almost touching the ground, was a hanged man, his head grotesquely cocked, his flesh nearly picked clean by the birds. The grinding, creaking sound was the rope slipping back and forth. It was almost frayed through. That was how he had come to know he was in the West. He reached Butte City 2 days later, and the pain in his fingers and knees had gotten so bad that he had stopped for a full day, holed up in a motel room. Stretched out on the motel bed in the great silence, hot towels wrapped around his hands and knees, reading Lapham's Law and the Classes of Society, Judge Ferris looked like a weird cross between the Ancient Mariner and a Valley Forge survivor. Stocking up well on aspirin and brandy, he pushed on, patiently searching out secondary roads, putting the scout in four-wheel drive and churning his muddy way around wrecks rather than using the winch when he could, so as to spare himself the necessary flexing and bending that came with attaching it. On the night of September 4th, 3 days before Bobby Terry spotted him passing through Copperfield, he had camped in New Meadows, and a rather unsettling thing had happened. He had pulled in at the Ranch Hand Motel, got a key to one of the units in the office, and had found a bonus, a battery-operated heater which he set up by the foot of his bed. Dusk had found him really warm and comfortable for the first time in a week. The heater put out a strong, mellow glow. He had stripped to his underwear shorts, propped up on the pillows, and reading about a case where an uneducated black woman from Brixton, Mississippi, had been sentenced to 10 years on a common shoplifting offense. The assistant DA who had tried the case and three of the jurors had been black, and Lapham seemed to be pointing out that... Tap, tap, tap at the window. The judge's old heart staggered in his chest. Lapham went flying. He grabbed for the gerund, leaning against the chair, and turned to the window, ready for anything. His cover story went flying through his mind like jackstraws blown in the wind. This was it. They'd want to know who he was, where he'd come from. It was a crow. The judge relaxed a little at a time and managed a small, shaken smile. Just a crow. It sat on the outer sill in the rain, its glossy feathers pasted together in a comic way, its little eyes looking through the dripping pane at one very old lawyer and the world's oldest amateur spy, lying on a motel bed in western Idaho, wearing nothing but boxer shorts in a pillow tick design, a heavy law book across his big belly. The crow almost seemed to grin at the sight. The judge relaxed all the way and grinned back. That's right. The joke's on me. But after 2 weeks of pushing on alone through this empty country, he felt he had a right to be a little jumpy. Tap, tap, tap. The judge's smile faltered. There was something in the way the crow was looking at him that he didn't quite like. It still seemed to almost grin, but he could have sworn it was a contemptuous grin, a kind of sneer. Tap, 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 like the raven that had flown in to roost on the bust of Pallas. When will I find out the things they need to know back in the free zone that seems so far away? Nevermore. Will I get any idea what chinks there might be in the dark man's armor? Nevermore. Will I get back safe? Nevermore. Tap, tap, tap. The crow, looking in at him, seeming to grin. And it came to him with a dreamy, testicle-shriveling certainty that this was the dark man, his soul, his ka, somehow projected into this rain-drenched, grinning crow that was looking in at him, checking up on him. He stared at it, fascinated. The crow's eyes seemed to grow larger. They were rimmed with red, he noticed, a darkly rich ruby color. Rainwater dripped and ran, dripped and ran. The crow leaned forward and very deliberately tapped on the glass. It thinks it's hypnotizing me. And maybe it is a little, but maybe I'm too old for such things. And suppose... it's silly, of course, but suppose it is him. And suppose I could bring that rifle up in one quick snap motion. It's been 4 years since I shot any skeet, but I was club champion back in 66 and again in 69 and still pretty good in 76. Not great, no ribbon that year, so I gave it up. Didn't have the eyesight anymore. But I was still good enough to place fifth in a field of 22. And that window's a lot closer than skeet shooting distance. If it was him, could I kill him? Trap his ka, if there is such a thing, inside that dying crow body? Would it be so unfitting if an old geezer could end the whole thing by the undramatic murder of a blackbird in western Idaho? The crow grinned at him. He was now quite sure it was grinning. With a sudden lunge, the judge sat up, bringing the Garand up to his shoulder in a quick, sure motion. He did it better than he ever would have dreamed. A kind of terror seemed to seize the crow. Its rain-drenched wings fluttered, spraying drops of water. Its eyes seemed to widen in fear. The judge heard it utter a strangled caw, and he felt a moment's triumphant certainty. It was the black man, and he had misjudged the judge, and the price for it would be his miserable life. "Eat this!" the judge thundered, and squeezed the trigger. But the trigger would not depress, because he had left the safety on. And a moment later, the window was empty, except for the rain. The judge lowered the Garand to his lap, feeling dull and stupid. He told himself it was just a crow, after all, a moment's diversion to liven up the evening. And if he had blown out the window and let the rain in, he would have had to go to the botheration of changing rooms. But he slept poorly that night, and several times he started awake and stared toward the window, convinced that he heard a ghostly tapping sound there. And if the crow happened to land there again, it wouldn't get away. He left the safety catch off the rifle. But the crow didn't come back. The next morning he had driven west again, his arthritis no worse, but certainly no better. And at just past 11 he had crossed the Snake into Homestead. He stopped at a small cafe for lunch, and as he finished his sandwich and thermos of coffee, he had seen a large black crow flutter down and land on the telephone wire half a block up the street. The judge watched it, fascinated. The red thermos cup stopped dead, halfway between the table and his mouth. It wasn't the same crow, of course not. There must be millions of crows by now, all of them plump and sassy. It was a crow's world now. But all the same, he felt that it was the same crow. And he felt a presentiment of doom, a creeping resignation that it was all over. He was no longer hungry. He pushed on. At 12:15, now in Oregon and moving west on Highway 86, he drove through the town of Copperfield, not even glancing toward the Five and Dime where Bobby Terry watched him go by, slack-jawed with amazement. The Garand was beside him on the seat, the safety still off, a box of ammo beside it. The judge had decided to shoot any crow he might see, just on general principles. "Faster! Can't you move this fucking thing any faster? You get off my ass, Bobby Terry. Just because you were asleep at the switch is no reason to get on my butt." Dave Roberts was behind the wheel of the Willys International that had been parked nose out in the alley beside the Five and Dime. By the time Bobby Terry had gotten Dave awake and up and dressed, the old geezer and the scout had gotten a 10-minute start on them. The rain was coming down hard, and visibility was poor. Bobby Terry was holding a Winchester across his lap. There was a .45 Colt tucked in his belt. Dave, who was wearing cowboy boots, jeans, a yellow foul weather slicker, and nothing else, glanced over at him. "You keep squeezing the trigger of that rifle, and you're going to blow a hole right through your door, Bobby Terry." "You just catch him," Bobby Terry said. He muttered to himself, "The guts. Gotta shoot him in the guts. It hasn't marked the head. Right." "Stop talking to yourself." "Where is he?" Bobby Terry asked. "We'll get him, unless you dreamed the whole thing. I wouldn't want to be in your shoes if you did, brother." "I didn't. It was that scout. But what if he turns off?" "Turns off where?" Dave asked. "There's nothing but farm roads all the way to the interstate. He couldn't get 50 feet up a one of them without going into the mud up to his fenders, four-wheel drive and all. Look at there. We're sniffing up his ass now." Ahead of them was a months-old head-on collision between a Chevy and a big, heavy Buick. They lay in the rain, blocking the road from one side to the other like the rusted bones of unburied mastodons. To the right, deep, fresh tire tracks were printed into the shoulder. "That's him," Dave said. "Those tracks ain't 5 minutes old." He swung the Willys out and around the smash-up, and they bounced wildly along the shoulder. Dave swung back onto the road where the judge had before him, and they both saw the muddy herringbone pattern of the scout's tires on the asphalt. At the top of the next hill, they saw the scout just disappearing over a knoll some 2 miles distant. "Howdy doody," Dave Roberts cried. "Go for broke." He floored the accelerator and the Willys crept up to 60. The windshield was a silvery blur of rain that the wipers could not hope to keep up with. At the top of the knoll, they saw the scout again, closer. Dave yanked out his headlight switch and began to work the dimmer switch with his foot. After a few moments, the scout's taillights flashed on. "All right," Dave said. "We act friendly. Get him to step out." "Don't you go off half-cocked, Bobby Terry. If we do this right, we're going to have a couple of suites at the MGM Grand in Vegas. So don't you fuck up. Get him to step out." "Oh, my God, why couldn't he have come through Robinette?" Bobby Terry whined. His hands were locked on the Winchester. Dave whacked at one of them. "You don't carry that rifle out either." "But shut up! Get a smile on you, goddamn you." Bobby Terry began to grin. It was like watching a mechanical funhouse clown grin. "You no good," Dave snarled. "Stay in the damn car." They had pulled even with the scout, which was idling with two wheels on the pavement and two on the soft shoulder. Smiling, Dave got out. His hands were in the pockets of his yellow slicker. In the left-hand pocket was a .38 police special. The judge climbed carefully down from the scout. He was also wearing a yellow rain slicker. He walked carefully, bearing himself the way a man might bear a fragile vase. The arthritis was loose in him like a pack of tigers. He carried the Garand rifle in his left hand. "Hey, you won't shoot me with that, will you?" the man from the Willys said with a friendly grin. "I guess not," the judge said. They spoke over the steady hiss of the rain. "You must have been back in Copperfield." "So we were. I'm Dave Roberts." He stuck out his right hand. "Ferris is my name," said the judge, and put out his own right hand. He glanced up toward the passenger window of the Willys and saw Bobby Terry leaning out, holding his .45 in both hands. Rain was dripping off the barrel. His face, dead pale, was still frozen in that maniacal funhouse grin. Oh, bastard, the judge murmured, pulling his hand out of Roberts's rain slippery grip, just as Roberts fired through the pocket of his slicker. The bullet plowed through the judge's midsection just below the stomach, flattening, spinning, mushrooming, coming out to the right of his spine, leaving an exit hole the size of a tea saucer. The Garand fell from his hand onto the road, and he was driven back into the scout's open driver's side door. None of them noticed the crow that had fluttered down to a telephone wire on the far side of the road. Dave Roberts took a step forward to finish the job. As he did, Bobby Terry fired from the passenger window of the Willys. His bullet took Roberts in the throat, tearing most of it away. A fury of blood cascaded down the front of Roberts' slicker and mixed with the rain. He turned toward Bobby Terry, his jaw working in soundless, dying amazement, his eyes bulging. He took two shuffling steps forward, and then the amazement went out of his face. Everything went out of it. He fell dead. Rain plinked and drummed on the back of his slicker. "Oh, shit, look at this!" Bobby Terry cried in utter dismay. The judge thought, "My arthritis is gone. If I could live, I could stun the medical profession. The cure for arthritis is a bullet in the guts. Oh, dear God, they were laying for me. Did Flagg tell them? He must have. Jesus help whoever else the committee sent over here." The Garand was lying on the road. He bent for it, feeling his guts trying to run right out of his body. Strange feeling. Not very pleasant. Never mind. He got hold of it. Was the safety off? Yes. He began to bring it up. It seemed to weigh 1,000 pounds. Bobby Terry ripped his stunned gaze away from Dave at last, just in time to see the judge preparing to shoot him. The judge was sitting on the road. His slicker was red with blood from chest to hem. He had settled the barrel of the Garand on his knee. Bobby snapped a shot and missed. The Garand went off with a giant thunderclap, and jagged glass sprayed Bobby Terry's face. He screamed, sure he was dead. Then he saw that the left half of the windshield was gone, and understood that he was still in the running. The judge was ponderously correcting his aim, swiveling the Garand perhaps 2 degrees on his knee. Bobby Terry, his nerves entirely shot now, fired 3 times in rapid succession. The first bullet spanged a hole through the side of the scout's cab. The second struck the judge above the right eye. A .45 is a large gun, and at close range it does large, unpleasant things. This bullet took off most of the top of the judge's skull and hurled it back into the scout. His head tilted back radically, and Bobby Terry's third bullet struck the judge 1/4 of an inch below his lower lip, exploding his teeth into his mouth, where he aspirated them with his final breath. His chin and jawbone disintegrated. His fingers squeezed the Garand's trigger in a dying convulsion, but the bullet went wild into the white, rainy sky. Silence descended. Rain drummed on the roofs of the scout and the Willys, on the slickers of the 2 dead men. It was the only sound, until the crow took off from the telephone wire with a raucous caw. That startled Bobby Terry out of his daze. He got slowly down from the passenger seat, still clutching the smoking .45. "I did it," he said confidentially to the rain. "Killed his ass. You better believe it. Old Bobby Terry just killed him as dead as you'd want." But with dawning horror, he realized that it wasn't the judge's ass he'd killed after all. The judge had died leaning back into the scout. Now Bobby Terry grabbed the lapels of his slicker and yanked him forward, staring at what remained of the judge's features. There was really nothing left but his nose. To tell the truth, that wasn't in such hot shape either. It could have been anyone. And in a dream of terror, Bobby Terry again heard Flagg saying, "I want to send him back undamaged." Holy God, this could be anyone. It was as if he had set out to deliberately do just the opposite of what the walking dude had ordered. 2 direct hits in the face. Even the teeth were gone. Rain drumming, drumming. It was over here. That was all. He didn't dare go east, and he didn't dare stay in the west. It would be crucifixion or worse. Were there worse things? With that grinning freak in charge, Bobby Terry had no doubt that there were. So what was the answer? Running his hands through his hair, still looking down at the ruined face of the judge, he tried to think. South. That was the answer. South. No border guards anywhere. South to Mexico. And if that wasn't far enough, get on down to Guatemala, Panama, maybe fucking Brazil. Opt out of the whole mess. No more east, no more west, just Bobby Terry. Safe and as far away from the walking dude as his old boogie shoes could carry him. A new sound in the rainy afternoon. Bobby Terry's head jerked up. The rain, yes, making its steel drum sound on the cabs of the two vehicles, and the grumbling of two idling motors, and a strange clocking sound, like run-down boot heels hammering swiftly along the secondary road MacAdam. No, Bobby Terry whispered. He began to turn around. The clocking sound was speeding up. A fast walk, a trot, a jog, run, sprint. And Bobby Terry got all the way around, too late. He was coming. Flag was coming like some terrible horror monster out of the scariest picture ever made. The dark man's cheeks were flushed with jolly color, and his eyes were twinkling with happy good fellowship, and a great, hungry, voracious grin stretched his lips over huge tombstone teeth, shark teeth, and his hands were held out in front of him, and there were shiny black crow feathers fluttering from his hair. No, Bobby Terry tried to say, but nothing came out. Hey, Bobby Terry, you screwed it up, the dark man bellowed, and fell upon the hapless Bobby Terry. There were worse things than crucifixion. There were teeth.